Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Conscious Capitalist Show. I'm your host, King, and I'm happy to say that I'm, again, in my gratitude space and living a great day. And I'd like to share my moment of gratitude, which is I'm grateful for being alive. I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful for my ability to see, hear, walk, talk, stand, breathe, and have a sound mind. I'm also grateful for the love and support from all of my friends and family members. I'm grateful for another 24 hours, another day to pursue my purpose in life. And I'm grateful to be in a position to continue to broadcast this show live to you all. And I'm very excited today because we're going to be having another spotlight of what I like to consider to be a Baltimore hero. It's a lady who has done some incredible things, I feel, in her life here in Baltimore City, has brought some incredible value to the city, and has shown a true strength of resilience and fortitude, and walks around with a great amount of elegance, elegance and dignity in the way she carries herself. And she is someone who I wanted to have on the show for some time. I've been wanting to talk to her. I have good friends and a mentor and a coach to her daughter, and I've come to know her through that relationship, but now we get a chance to really focus on her and some of the very interesting and challenging things she's gone through in her life. So without any further ado, I'd like to read you all her bio so you understand the context. Najuma Yassin is a vibrant, energetic, confident, and believable 68-year young woman. Despite the odds she has faced in life and continues to thrive. Najuma is also the proud mother of 6 children, 24 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren. Najuma grew up in Baltimore in the 50s, which was a time where you can leave your doors open and open all night, and you knew all your neighbors would look out for you like they were your parents. Najuma started her colorful work career at 14 years of age at a Jewish catering company and has had at least 16 different professions, from an administrative assistant in a funeral home to a correction officer in a men's institution. While Najuma is not at the daycare helping her daughter out, she is working in her garden, decorating her home, working on her skin, and reading a good book or out hand dancing. Sounds interesting. And so without any further ado, welcome to the Conscious Capitalist Show, Najuma. How are you doing today? Hello, Najuma, can you hear me? Hello, Najuma. Might be having a technical difficulty. Let me make sure she can hear me. Well, I'll work on that technical difficulty to get Najuma to make sure she can hear me. I'm going to continue to talk about the importance of what I consider to be Baltimore heroes. And I think that it's important to be able to highlight Baltimore heroes because this city, from a media standpoint, only puts out very negative information. And so that's what this show is about. It's really showcasing that there is folks here in Baltimore City who are doing great work and doing great things, and that these folks need to be highlighted, in my opinion. And that's what this show is about, whether they're in the business world or whether they're in a community world and community leaders giving out and their time and effort to make Baltimore a better city, the city that I've come to love. And that's what the show is about, highlighting those individuals who are doing that great work. So, Najuma, can you hear me? Are you with us? Hello, Najuma?
Yes.
Yes, welcome to the show. You can hear me now, correct?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I couldn't hear you before. I can hear you well now, yes.
Okay, good.
Well, I'd like to get the show started by what I believe is asking each person what they're grateful for. Because I believe definitely in these times that we're dealing with now, more importantly, anytime really, but now more importantly, you know, I think we should focus on the things that we're grateful for. So would you share with the listening audience your moment of gratitude?
I am grateful for my life, my health, my understanding of what life is about. I'm grateful for my family, my friends, and to be where the position that I'm in at this time. I am grateful for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that with us. So let's get started. So the first question I want to ask is, let's get started with your name. Najuma is a very unique and beautiful name. Does it have any special meaning?
Yes, it does. In Swahili, it means abounding in joy. In Arabic, it means radiant and brilliant. So it has a few meanings depending on where the name derives.
Okay. And do you feel that your name fits you? I think it does. I just was curious.
Yes, it does. Most definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Now, and reading your bio and some good information in your bio. So I'm curious to know, how was it growing up in Baltimore City over the past 6.5 decades? As a black female?
Well, for me, I was married young. So I was into taking care of my family. So there might have been some things that I missed. Having a husband and 6 children was a feat. So we managed. We tried to keep food on the table, roof overhead, making sure we don't get put out next week. That's where my focus was, in taking care of my family. So that's what it was like for me for that time. I was married over 30 years the first time. So I was taking care of my family.
Now, from what I've experienced here in Baltimore, and of course, some of the things that I've read about Baltimore City as well, was the racism as blatant as what I read about coming up in Baltimore City during those decades?
I would say it's more now, more now. Yes, I say more so now. And like I said, I was just in a different place. What was important to me in taking care of the family and making sure we were all taken care of, that's why I said maybe some things I missed. Working and like I said, making sure we weren't, when I came around the corner, that my furniture was still in the house. So those are things that were important to me.
Right.
You know,
I understand.
Making sure everything wasn't set out and the lights were still on, the water was still on. Those were things that were of utmost importance to me. So,
absolutely.
Like I said, I might have missed some things.
Absolutely. Now, was there anyone that you looked to for inspiration that kind of you modeled yourself after or just kind of gained some insight from to say, this is somebody who can help me kind of navigate those challenges of just keeping a family structured and keeping a family together and keeping a roof over your head?
I would say my inspiration was my grandmother, my mother's mother. She was this tiny little woman from Ellaville, Georgia. And she came to Baltimore. I forget what year it was. But she came here and she bought her home. Her and my grandfather bought their home. And she had a beautiful home. She had a peach tree, a pear tree, a grape harbor. She had land in Anne Arundel County where she had chickens, hogs. She had land where she had corn, tomatoes. She had vegetables, a vegetable garden where she fed her family from her land. She took care of her family. She bought all of her furniture from, I don't know if you're familiar with, there was a it still is here, a furniture store on South Charles Street called Chauffeurs. And I'm sure she had to go in the basement to purchase her furniture, but she bought her furniture with cash. She was, that's my hero. She's my shero. She was not formal educated, but she was a hustler. She sold Mother's Day flowers. She sold apple on the stick. She sold, she had a little restaurant. She opened on the weekends. She was a wonderful woman. She worked in her yard. I learned so much from her. So she was my inspiration.
And I can see why. I mean, you know, owning your own home, even at, during that time frame, is something that's impressive, considering that they didn't make that an easy feat for us. They don't make it an easy feat for us now, but it's much more, it's at least a process. Well, back then, it was just blatant out restrictions against blacks owning homes, particularly in Baltimore City.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So for her to achieve that feat, and then, like you said, opening businesses and still have another revenue streams, that's definitely, I can see why she's a hero to you, or a shero to you, as you say.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Now, you kind of answered some of this question before, but I just want to kind of be more specific with it, because I think it's a very important question, and mainly because of what the media says about Baltimore City constantly, that it's full of crime, full of drugs, full of violence, you know, full of poverty. And so with that context, how, as you growing up in the city, how were you able to pretty much avoid those systems? I know you said you were married, kind of focused, but if you can kind of answer that per decade, like when you were dealing with being married and post your marriage, and just kind of how you stayed away from that through the entire time that you pretty much have been living here in Baltimore City.
Well, all the time you don't have to experience things in order for you to say, you know what, that's not something I'm interested in. So drugs wasn't something I personally was interested in doing. I stayed away from that. I saw the effects of it, and it wasn't something I personally wanted to do. The violence, yes, those things plagued the city, and I think with the media, these are a lot of the things that are put before us. There are so many young people, and not just young people, but people that are doing positive things, good things, that's you don't hear about. You hear about maybe through some other type of media, but that's not what's put before us a lot of times. There are still a lot of good people here in the city that are doing good things. We just don't hear about it.
Right.
And I escaped it because I think it wasn't something I wasn't interested in. So I wasn't around people that were doing drugs or doing violent things. I wasn't around that. I stayed away from it. Personally, I did.
Right, right. And I think that's important. That's why I really wanted to bring that point up, is that making those choices in your life, you know, even though the environment around you may be chaotic in that context, but you don't have to be a victim of your environment. And
exactly.
you've been able to show that in choices that you've made, been able to make in your life.
Right, right.
Now, what are some of the things that I could say, I believe that to be successful in life, we, as human beings, we operate off patterns and rituals, and that we do these daily rituals, and these rituals pretty much define how we're going to, you know, look at the day and view the day and what we experience throughout the week and so on and so forth. So what are some of the key rituals that you do on a daily basis to help keep your mind focused, particularly during this pandemic that we're dealing with right now?
Well, some of the things that I do, I try to do yoga, and I was also doing Pilates until I had a little incident with my left arm. I broke my left arm. And so I'm just a little, I have to be a little careful now, but I stay centered. In staying centered, I know what's going on around me, but I don't let it affect me in a way where I come apart. I still have to stay grounded. I have to stay grounded, and so that's what I do. I every day when I get up, the first thing I say is, thank you. Thank you, because I'm so grateful to still be able to get up with my right mind, be able to have health. I'm not sickly. I'm well and healthy. So I have so much to be thankful for that I realize the pandemic is going on, but I'm not going to let it bring me down. In other words, I'm not going to let it bring me down.
I understand. Understanding. Saying we're here, I really think that's the only way to really function, because if you allow yourself to watch your news constantly, then it's going to put you in a state of confusion and depression, because they don't know what they're talking about. They change on a daily basis, and the government has this way of dealing with it. And then I can see where if that's all you did was feed your mind that kind of information, then you would be stressed out. You would be worried.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to live like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm taking the precautions that I need to. Don't get me wrong. I'm taking the precautions that I need to, but I'm not going to inundate myself with it, because I still have to enjoy my life. I have to. I feel like
absolutely.
I've come too far not to continue to enjoy my life. There's a time when I was bogged down and I wasn't really able to, but now, no, I'm free now. So I have to enjoy every day that I'm blessed to see.
Absolutely. That's a great attitude to have. Absolutely. Now, you started your working career at the age of 14. Was there any, and that's relatively young. I don't believe I started my career until I was 15. You know, I wanted to work when I was 14, but they weren't allowing us in St. Louis at that time to even take a job. McDonald's was my first job. You had to be 15.
Mm-hmm.
So was there any particular event or memory that stands out the most from you for that first job that you had?
Yes. This friend of mine told me that he worked at this catering company and they needed some extra people. And he said, I think you'd be able to do it. He said, so would you like to? So I asked my mom and she said, sure. So I went to this catering company, and you worked on mostly Jewish holidays. It was a Jewish catering company, so it was their holidays that they had and some weekends. And what stands out the most to me is we already ate in the kitchen, and I was okay with that. And the hired help, we ate in the kitchen. And one particular day when we were working, the manager said, he seemed like he was, I think something was going wrong with the affair. And so he took it out on the workers, and he said, I need you all to go outside and eat today. And I said, eat outside? And he said, because it was like in the back. And I said, I don't want to eat outside. He said, I want everybody to just go outside and eat. And so I looked to my friend and I said to him, today will be my last day working here. And he said, why, why? He said, he gets like that sometimes. I said, I don't have to work. I still live at home with my parents. I don't have to work here. I don't care to take that kind of treatment. And I didn't go back. So that stands out to me. So, and I didn't go back. I was still working. I was still at home. So I didn't really have to work. I wanted to because I wanted to have money to buy my little personal items and maybe get some clothing I saw for myself. So, but I didn't have to work.
Understanding. You know, my first couple of jobs, I had the same kind of mentality. It wasn't until I was about maybe 22, because I remember, like I said, I had worked at McDonald's. I worked at a cemetery cutting grass, and I ended up having to work at a restaurant washing dishes. And based on how those managers or my supervisors would talk to me or treat me, because most of the people I worked with was always older, you know. So like you said, I was young. So I had the mentality, I don't have to be here. You know, I can just leave. Mm-hmm. This is something I want to do so I can buy my own little personal things that my parents won't buy. I can buy my wants,
right.
but my needs are taken care of. So I don't have to be here to deal with this type of treatment. So I definitely understand and respect that.
Right. The there was another, I think I was 16, and I worked at a funeral home. And at the time, you had to go down through the embalming room in the back room to make your phone calls to the newspaper to call in the obituaries. And I didn't want to go down through that room, because you had to walk past the bodies, and I just didn't care to see that. And so one particular day I was in the one of the manager's office making the phone calls, and his wife came in and said, what are you doing in here? And I said, I'm making phone calls to the newspapers. She said, oh, you can't make the phone calls in here. You have to go down in the room down in the basement. I said, well, I don't want to be in the basement. I don't like walking through the, seeing the body. She said, well, that's what you're going to have to do. I said, okay. I went down there that day. And when I came from, I made the calls, and I came back upstairs, and the cleaning lady who was there, I asked her, could she spray my clothing, because I felt like I smelled like death. And
ooh,
she sprayed me. Because, you know, you go through that room, everything has a really a bad odor. And so I came back up, and I said to the wife, I said, today is going to be my last day. I'm quitting. And she's like, why? I said, because I cannot go to that room to make the calls. And I picked up my purse, and I left. And by the time I got, my mom had worked in a beauty salon. And I stopped at the beauty salon on my way home. And my mother said, they called me from the funeral home and said that you quit. And she wants you to come back. I said, I'm not going back. And she said, please, she said, well, can you at least call her? I said, there's no need to call her. I already explained to her what it was I didn't want to do, and she told me I had to do it, and so I'm not going back. I'll find another job. And that's what I did. I never went back. So, yeah.
Did you ever talk to her?
There was no need to call her. I felt like this. I said it to you while I was there. I don't like going to that room. And she said, well, you have to. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. And so she was changing it, but it was too late then. I didn't care to go back because I could always find a job. So that wasn't a problem. But I wasn't going to be treated like that. So
Understandable.
I was still living at home. So I didn't have to take that. You know.
Now, what would you say that you're most proud of your illustrious career?
Let me see. I would say I'm most proud that I've been a professional wherever I worked. I had ethical standards. I had a great sense of responsibility. Whatever I took on, I did a good job at it. I was always praised at work, wherever I worked. I'll say most places that I worked. The management was always, they never wanted me to leave. Wanted me to leave because I did such a good job. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud that in my careers, I always did a good job. I did what I was supposed to do, and I did a good job. I was good at what I did. So I'm proud of that.
That is something to be proud of. You know, there's this book called The Four Agreements, and it's written by I'm actually forgetting his name now, but the premise of the book is four agreements. One of the agreements is you always do your best or you don't do it at all. And Don Miguel Ruiz is the author of the book. And what you said, that's the agreement that reminded me of always do your best. When you say you're a professional all the time and that's what you're most proud of in your career, it's always do your best. And even Booker T. Washington once said that even if your job is to just be the street sweeper, then be the best street sweeper you can possibly be.
Exactly. That's what I did.
And I could definitely respect that as well. I could definitely respect that.
Yes.
Now, when I was reading your bio, what I found to be one of the most interesting things about your bio, you talked about growing up in the 50s, and you said there was a time you can leave your doors open all night and you knew all your neighbors, and they looked out for you like they were your parents. And I know that I grew up in the 70s, and we didn't leave our doors open, but we definitely had that village type of environment where anybody that was an adult could be my parent and discipline me and my brothers. So I'm curious to know what it was like growing up in the 50s in Baltimore when you were able to leave your doors open. Can you share a little bit of that experience with us?
It was a wonderful time. I mean, wonderful, because your neighbors were your friends. You knew everybody. You knew everybody, not just your neighbors in your block. You knew the whole community. You knew the community. You knew when you went to the store, you knew the cashier. You knew the cashier. You knew her children. You knew everybody in the community. It was such a I know, and it probably sounds unbelievable now just in comparison, but it was such a good time to grow up to me, because you were just, you just had friends. You all the neighbors, you were friendly. Of course, you had your little scuffs, but your parents and the neighbors were friends. Everybody knew everybody. The neighbors looked out for you. They were like, they were just like family. Everybody was like family. The person who worked on your car at the gas station, you knew them. Everybody was, it was a wonderful time. The person who was on the movie theater at the time, you knew who he was. It was more trust. You trusted people. It was, like I said, it was a wonderful time in my life, and I see such a difference now because I wave to neighbors now, but it's just not the same. I would never leave my doors unlocked now. You could
right.
leave. I just, you would never, you don't even think about that. You get as much security on your home as you can. You didn't have security on your home. You just didn't. You left the door open, and you knew that because you trusted your community so much, you knew no one was going to be breaking in your home. You knew that. It was good. It was good. As a matter of fact, where we used to live when it was time for us to move, I cried. I didn't want to leave that area because it was where I was. It was a comfort zone. So it was very comfortable, but I enjoyed that time of my life. I really did. It was, the 50s was a good time, really good.
You know, as you're saying that, I was thinking about picturing that in my mind, the neighborhood I'm living in here in Baltimore. Like, you're absolutely right. Could not leave our doors open, but that is something that part of the work that I'm doing, and I see it as my purpose in life, is to create this conscious community. And it's a community that all the people who live in that same, on that block or within that community, all have the same type of mindset. We want to have a safe community for ourselves. We look out for each other. People can depend and trust one another. You don't have strangers living next door to you. You have folks that you actually have, you know their names, you know some, you know enough about their business that if you see something strange going on in their house, that you can report that. And it's that natural caring for one another that I think that was key. And I, as I said, I read so much about the 50s, the 60s time frame, and how as a people we suffered from racism. But here you talk about how a community thrived, and from the movie theater to the store clerk to everybody just knowing one another and having that self-contained community. Those are some of the things that don't get shared about as much. And I think that's something that we as the younger generation definitely need to learn from. And hopefully we can duplicate that again, at least some aspects of that.
I hope you can, but it's I'm not going to say it's far-fetched, but it's going to be a feat. It's going to have its challenges, I think. Definitely going to have its challenges.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yes.
But hearing that it was at one point it's possible.
Oh yeah,
that's what fuels me. And I know with the drugs is always going to be drugs now and so much poverty that we can never leave our doors open again because it's going to be people out there that's going to break in, take advantage of those situations because of those two extremes.
But I
do look forward to just everybody at least knowing one another and everybody at least caring about the other person enough to say, how you doing? How's your day coming?
Right. That would be nice. That would really be nice. The poverty part of it, we moved, I'm going to say, somewhere between 10 and 13 times. And so, I mean, we lived in, I called them sugar shacks. We lived in some horrible, horrible places. But I'm just grateful we made it out of there. But we lived in some really bad places, really bad. And I'm just, I guess I can just say that's why one of the things, reasons I'm so grateful today for so many things, because of what I've come through, what I've been blessed to come through, put it like that.
So, absolutely.
I do understand.
And that's an excellent,
yes.
That's an excellent segue to my next question, which is, what would you say has been one of the most challenging things that you have to face in your life, or a time, a job, situation, wherever you feel that there's something you want to share that you felt was the most challenging part that you had to deal with in your life?
The most challenging thing that I've had to deal with was losing two sons. That's the tops for me. That's my barometer for everything else. Losing them here in the streets of Baltimore is the most, there's nothing else that can top that. That's my tops. That's my tops. Yes, that's it.
Understandably so.
I'm grateful that I am where I am right now, but it was, or has been, that has been a rough road. I never gave up, or never was angry with the Creator. I'll use it like that. I was never angry with the Creator. I just asked Him to just get me through this, because I'll never be over it, but get me through it. And I'm in a pretty good place today. I'll say today, because it's not something that ever goes away. It never ever goes away. So, but that for me was my challenge. The hardest thing I've had to deal with.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, and I definitely could not imagine that. I don't have kids, for one, but I can, from what I've experienced from other folks around me and family members, that is something that definitely plagues our community so much, with the violence, that it's become almost a part of who we are. I don't think I know too many families that have not been touched by that death of the senseless violence that has plagued our community. So getting through that, and the strength that you've been able to show, like I said, is a true testament to who you are as a person, and the fact that you're not a bitter person. You're not walking around and let yourself get consumed in alcohol and drugs, because those are some of the things that people choose to do as a result of those traumatic experiences. You know, but you've been able
and
to...
And you know what? Right, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, and I understand that. I understand if someone chose to do those things. I understand why they did. I just didn't. But I understand, because it's like, until you've gone through it, sometimes people say, oh, I understand. I know what you've been through. No, you don't. Unless it has happened to you. Losing a child, for me, is the worst thing that's ever happened to me, the worst. I don't have anything to top that, nothing. Nothing can top that. Because they were just a part of me. A part of me.
Absolutely.
And I did go through therapy the first time to help get me through, because I came apart at the seams. I came apart. And you don't know how you're going to deal with something until it happens to you. You can say, oh, I'm going to be able to do this. You don't know until it hits you. And I hope that I would be able to maybe help someone through it. But like I said, it's just through it. It's not over it, but just through it, because that's what it is. That's how I've I've learned to see it is crying is pushing out pain and just getting through it. But it takes, and there is no time frame. There is no time frame on it as to when you're going to stop crying and when you, there is no time. But I'm so much better now, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, you know, I think that's in some that you just said. I think it's profound, and I never heard it expressed that way. You said you don't get over it, you get through it. And I think that's something that
that's it.
People need to hear that. That needs to be shared, folks who are going to be dealing with those traumatic experiences. But I do have a question that I've always been wrestling with. And how do you think, do you think that therapy can actually help Black? Because as a community, as a culture, we don't usually go with the therapist. But white people go to therapists quite a bit. It's like, I talked to my therapist today, you know, where we don't, as a community, we don't seem to do that. Do you think that therapy helps in that context? Did it help you to kind of get through it, as you say?
I would say yes, it did. Because what happens is, when you've had a when you've lost a child or when you've lost a loved one, and I said a little earlier, coming apart at the seams, and for me that meant getting out of the bed was hard, getting in the shower was hard, getting dressed to go, all of that was, I want to just stay in the bed. I pushed through it, but I wanted to, I didn't want to do those things. I wanted to wallow. I wanted to stay in the bed and cry all day. And I pushed through it, but I decided to try therapy just to see. And I went, this is the first time when I lost my first son. I went to therapy. I went to see this therapist, and her office was her home, and she made it so conducive to what I was dealing with. When I looked out in her, she had a like a patio door, and straight through she had all these beautiful plants outside. And when I sat on the sofa, she had a the box of tissues right beside me. So I would look out in the beautiful garden and I could just talk to her. I could just talk. She would listen, because what happens is with your friends, and I don't care how long you've been knowing them, how close you are, talking to your friends and family about a loved one you lost is heavy. And sometimes it's too heavy for them. They may not tell you, but sometimes it's too heavy. So going to someone who had did not know me helped. It helped a lot. Because sometimes your friends and family will say, seems like you should be over that by now. It seems, you know, you're going to get your hair done, you're going to get your nails done. You seem like you should be better. But that doesn't mean that you're getting better or that you're feeling good now. So talking to someone who didn't know me helped me tremendously. I looked past I'm a Black woman needing therapy. I needed it. So I went and got it. I went past that, because that's how deep the hurt was. The hurt was that deep. I needed to talk to somebody else. And going to, I saw her every Saturday for, I'm trying to remember how, I saw her for months. Every Saturday I went to see her. And after I would leave her, I may go to a boutique or a thrift shop and do something that I enjoyed. But I might have even cried once I got in there. But it really helped me get to another place. in the grief. It helped me. I mean, I read books. I did those things as well. But going to the therapy really helped me. And it just so happened the following year, it was like I knew it had already happened, but it was like I could feel it coming back all over again. So I went again, and it helped me again. I saw someone different this time, but it was good for me. It was good for me. It let up from talking to family and friends. I gave them a break. That's what it also did, giving them a break. But it for me, it was good. And I was good.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I could definitely say that, you know, I'm sure our listening audience appreciate it, but I can tell you that personally I appreciate it just because of the fact is that's a question I've wrestled with in my mind is that I don't think we go through enough therapy in our community. We just kind of we've always been taught to just deal with it. You know, that
Black people don't go to therapists.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's some of the same kind of thoughts. That's why I think we have people who express that pain in other ways as a result. Because it's going to have to come out of you. It's going to have to come out of you in some way, some form of fashion.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yes. Talk to somebody about it. Somebody who's trained. Somebody who can help you.
Exactly. That's helpful. The key thing is trained, who won't judge you and then won't go gossip behind your back about what you said to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I had a very close friend she was my godmother at the time. And when I told her that I had lost my son, she didn't understand. And our relationship changed because when she would call me, she would say, "You should be over this by now." And that's not something you say to a mother that has lost a child. You never say that.
Right.
And she would say, "But you gotta move on in your life." But she didn't understand because one, she still had her children. And she didn't understand that the time frame from when that happens to you, your time is not the same anymore. You even know the sun is shining, but I was in a fog, a complete fog. It looked foggy every day to me. So your time slows up. You know that today is... what is today? Tuesday. You know that, but your timing is off from when it happens. It's not the same. And people will say certain things to you about you got to move. You got to go. Life goes on. Yes, it does go on. But for you, your life is slowed up. That's the only way I can explain it. It slows up. You're just on another time frame. It's not the same as everybody else's. So I never wanted to know about this, but I do. And maybe I can help somebody else. But it hasn't been an easy road, but I'm glad I am where I am now.
Absolutely. Well, I could definitely say that in sharing that today is definitely I receive it. And I think that the conversation about therapy and, like I said, you don't get over it, you get through it. I think that's something that folks can definitely find solace in.
Yes.
Now, my next question is, I know you've had over 16 different careers in your 16 different professions in your career. And one of that I find to be one of the most interesting ones that when I found out about this, I've been curious about was you were a female correction officer.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that in a male's prison, no less? So I'm just really curious to know. So I've seen those prison documentaries on tape, on video or whatever, and I've heard people talk about prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always said to myself, I could, and they've always talked about it from a context that there's like two guards for 100 prisoners. For every 100 prisoners, there's two correction officers. So in hearing that, and now I actually get a chance to talk to somebody who actually was a correction officer, can you just describe that experience and what it was like being a female correction officer in a black, in a male prison?
Well, the first thing I'll say is because of the way I carried myself, the officers and I'll say overall the inmates gave me the utmost respect. I carried myself in a respectful manner. I did not mistreat the inmates. There are certain things I had to learn because when I first walked in that door and saw them out in the yard, I was like, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I mean, just looking at them. I mean, and they're like outside in the yard in a gate. I mean, and they had their hats on, you know, kind of cocked, acy-deucy, and they looked like they were growling at you. And I was like, oh, my gosh, what did I get myself into? But there's an adjustment period between you and the inmate. There's an adjustment. If they see that you are someone that is about their business, then they have respect for that. Because you also have to learn whatever they did, you're not there to judge them. I had to learn that. You're not there to judge them. You're there to do your job. Whatever it is you're supposed to do to, if they need soap, you can't say, well, I'm not giving him soap today because he cursed at me. Or he still needs soap. He can't go out and get his own soap. But they had an utmost respect for me. I carried myself a certain way. I kept myself clean from my head to my feet. My shoes were shiny every day. My uniform looked a certain way every day. So they respected me. And like I said, I didn't mistreat them. So I loved working, doing what I did. It was rough some days. And yes, there are days that you look when you're all at the time clock and you'll say, wow, it was just this amount of officers here today and we handled this. But that's how it is over the country with the population to correctional officers. That's how it is everywhere. But it's a dangerous job. It's a dangerous job. I mean, I'm glad I'm done, but definitely a dangerous job. But I handled myself well. And it just so happens the last position that I had there was releasing inmates. So I had my own space. I had to have sometimes sex offenders, getting them on the registry. So I had to do their fingerprints. And at that time, we didn't have the machine they use now to do it. I had to fingerprint, put the finger on, twist, turn it. So they were standing right beside me. So, I mean, I did my job. And like I said, I never, inmate never spat on me, never threw feces on me. I mean, it's been close, but it never happened. Never beat me up, any of that. So I had, like I said, I showed them respect, and they in turn had to respect me. So it was good for me.
And how many years were you?
It was a good experience.
And how many years did you have that job?
I did it for 9 years. I went there late in life. So that's where I retired from. So I went late. But I did a fantastic job while I was there. So like I said, I'm glad I retired. I'm glad I'm done now. But it was good for me. I learned an awful lot. I learned a lot about I remember being in case manager's office, and it was the day to see sex offenders, and I was able to, I had access to their information, and I was reading it, and I got the worst headache, and I was like, wait a minute, whatever they did, I don't have anything to do with that. I had to separate myself from that and treat that person the way I'm supposed to, because not because he's a sex offender, but because he's a human being, and I'm not here for that. He got his sentence. He was already sentenced. I can't sentence him again. That's not my business. My business is to treat him a certain way, make sure he doesn't have contraband, make sure he follows the rules. That's my job. And so once I learned how to do that, my headache went away, and I did what I was supposed to do there.
Yeah. Now, were you taught that type of thinking by one of the senior correctional officers? Because I'm just, what I've heard, again, I haven't experienced that, but what I've heard is that a lot of correctional officers come in with that attitude that I'm better than you and I'm going to make you suffer. You shouldn't be, you know, you in here, and I'm gonna make you suffer for being in here. And for you not to have that kind of mentality, is that something you went in there with, or is something someone said in order to survive this, in order to do this job well, this is how you have to think?
I went in there with that in my head because I wanted to go there and do a good job. And in order to do a good job, I had to I'm sorry, the phone was ringing.
No problem.
I lost my train of thought. Oh, I had to perform my job the way it was supposed to be performed. I couldn't not do that. So, but I did have a few officers who were gave me a lot of good information. Like, they had been there for years. So they gave me good information, and it helped me. It helped me along the way.
Okay. All right.
Really helped me a lot.
We're getting to the top of the hour. We pretty much have about 2 minutes left in the show.
Oh,
and
okay.
We definitely didn't get a chance to go through all the questions, obviously. But I definitely wanted to say that I definitely appreciate you for getting on the show, and thank you for investing the time and the energy and the honesty and answering the questions. I know they're going to definitely be helpful for our listening audience who listens to that, and we can allow Speed to be able to convey and demonstrate to the people what a conscious hero looks like, and somebody who can grow up in an environment that's full of chaos and violence, but not let that become who they are and still rise above. But I definitely
thank
would
you
like
so
to
much.
Have you back on the show again and have you on our real estate show too, because that was something else we didn't get a chance to get into any of those questions today. But I know you're a homeowner in Baltimore City, second time homeowner, and I definitely want to have you on our real estate show to talk about that experience and how you were able to pretty much successfully not only purchase your first home, but your second home, and so on and so forth. So I just want to request that for, first of all, and then again, thank you again for your honest and passionate answers that you've given today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you so much.
And thank you as well. And as we count down, we have 30 seconds left on our show. I just want to thank our listening audience again for tuning in to the Conscious Capitalist Show, and to remind everybody to continue to practice the CDC recommended guidelines of social distancing, washing your hands, and that we can get through this coronavirus and get back to some form of normalcy in our life. And to everyone else out there, let's continue to have faith, strive for greatness, and be more conscious. Thank you.
Thank you.